I got a sneak preview of the slides. Wow, this is rich. I think everyone knows who Dr. Siegel is, but I just had a quick look of what he's been publishing, because I knew what he's doing in addition to that. And it's about a paper a month. You know, if you read JAMA, if you read the Archives of Internal Medicine, if you read the Journal of Urology, if you read Urology, every month he'll be on the on the cover. A major interest area, UCLA, maybe born and bred isn't right to say, but
close.
But yeah, they have quite a while. And this is a perfect topic for our Seymour Comparative Effectiveness Research Seminar. And so I won't take any more of your time, because I think that it would be stealing it from the good stuff.
Okay, thanks. All right, so I wanted to talk a little bit today about decision making at the point of care. And I wanted to start off just discussing a little bit about decision making in general. So there's a few ways to think about how we make decisions. And one method of thinking about this is that we, you know, take a very rational view and come to a conclusion based on sort of a reductive view of the world. And some people think that decision making is best done in that kind of blink fashion. You use your gut. This is an example of sort of a purely rational decision. The color's a little off your chart. But basically, you know, this is a decision where someone has a hot dog stand. They want to open another one up. They want to make more money. They can go with a more risky strategy and open one on Rush Street. Maybe there's a small chance, a 20% chance they make $900 a week doing that. Or they could go on their current street, the solid street, and they could maybe have a higher likelihood chance of making less money, $500. So one way to evaluate this approach is to calculate the expected value of the decision. So you look at the probabilities, you assign the outcomes, $500 a week, $200 a week, you multiply them out, and you get an average estimate of what strategy would be best in a rational viewpoint. So the rational decider in this decision would go for the Rush Street location. However, is that how people make decisions? And the answer definitely is no. There's a whole field of economics called behavioral economics that's arisen to explain why people's behaviors don't follow that method. And you know, a lot of this is around framing biases, which a lot of us are familiar with. We really avoid the pain of a loss more avidly than we do seek out a similarly sized gain. And this is responsible for bubbles and the various financial asset classes in the country, panics, all kinds of human behavior can't be explained by rational decision making. So intuitive decision making can be key. You know, obviously it's evolutionarily beneficial. You know, you run and you see a fire. And in fact, it's the whole process of decision making does have an important emotional content. So in the part of the brain called the orbitofrontal cortex is damaged, people become emotionally mute. They, if you show them a picture of a very graphically violent scene, they have no reaction. However, if you ask them, where do you want to have lunch, they begin to perseverate. They do a cost-benefit analysis of every location in town, and they can't come to a decision. So something about emotional processing is key to coming to a decision. So at the same time, rational decision-making can be key in that, you know, we have plenty of opportunities to make bad choices in our society. Credit card teasers are one of them. If you use your rational brain to analyze the offer below, you will probably avoid a lot of pain. So there is some benefit to thinking about things in a rational context. So in my point of view, and my research agenda is kind of focused on this idea that you can combine both modalities of decision making to support a person who has a complex choice to make. So how does this relate to medical decision making? So, you know, we have a double-edged sword. We have constant innovations in treatments across oncology, primary care. All these treatments may offer trade-offs of which you should do versus another option. There's multiple moving parts, and these days, patient preferences and values play a key role in the best choice for any one particular patient. This is a simplified schematic of what a man who has prostate cancer has to face. And so basically, you know, you've got several choices here, there's sub-choices, and he's trying to balance out his concerns with his options. This creates what I think is called, Herb Simon, who's a very famous economist, called bounded rationality. You have a complex choice, you've got time constraints, we can only process so many data points at once, and essentially we begin to make non-rational choices because of that. I think it's possible that software can help us to expand the bounds in which we make decisions. and help us become more rational in our decision making. So how do we find an ideal decision in healthcare? I think all of us would agree that a patient-centered decision is really what we're aiming for here, and this reflects the needs, values, and preferences of a well-informed patient, as a succinct expression of that. How can you define if the patient-centered decision was of high quality? There's also ways of defining this. So initially in this field of decision quality, patient satisfaction and decisional conflict with constructs were measured, but they were augmented with other measures, including these to acknowledge whether the patient expressed his values for outcomes of interest, and whether the values were congruent with the treatment choice. So if you're a man having a TURP surgery and one of your values is really about fertility, your treatment should not really involve a risk to fertility. That kind of a simple concordance. So you can measure the decision quality. How can you perhaps achieve a higher decision quality? Well, shared decision making is one way to do that. There's many definitions of this concept, but essentially it's a collaboration between patients and physicians to come to an agreement about a healthcare decision, and it's useful in most of the decisions we make today in healthcare, I think. But there's a lot of barriers to shared decision making in practice. It takes a lot of time, physicians aren't compensated for that time, and there's a lot of numerical issues with patients that can be confronting. So what arose was were aids to help shared decision making, or offload this part of the decision out of the clinic maybe and have patients use it before they are seen by the doctor. And the Foundation for Informed Decision Making, Al Mulley, Jack Wenberg, all those guys have really pioneered that field over the last 20 years. And they have produced videos, pamphlets, lots of modalities that have been used in various trials. These aids address several challenges that I think are relevant today in the healthcare system. For patients, we have less access to doctor time. We're skeptical about doctors' advice. We've read articles about the amount of inappropriate care that's out there, and there's a lot of information overload facing us. As physicians, we have to do more with less time. We have patients coming in with gigantic stacks of internet printouts talking about things that are highly irrelevant. And we're worried about getting sued if we don't go over every little last detail with the patient. And then payers have a problem because they're at risk for care. They know a lot of care is inappropriate. And they would like to turn us into healthcare consumers. So decision aids have been shown to, over the last 20 years, to have some general effects that can help solve some of these problems, including increased patient involvement, increased patient knowledge, having the treatment and the patient values more concordant, and perhaps benefiting lawsuit issues. I think, and part of my research agenda is to define whether we can move to a next generation model of decision aids that not only takes into account some of the different styles of decision making that patients may have, but also takes advantage of some of the quantitative, the distribution of quantitative power that is cheaper and easier, more easily accessed. So I think that it's possible to create a rational model for a decision that accounts for all the outcomes and weighs the probabilities outcomes and helps the patient make a decision. So conceptually, it's like a decision analysis. For those of us that aren't familiar, this would be a very simplified schematic of that. You have a man who has three choices. Each of those choices has different probabilities. And to sort of solve that problem, on that hot dog vendor example, you have to have a value for each of those outcomes. And the crux of the matter in my research is how to find and define this value in a precise and reliable way that has meaning for the patient. So that's called, how do we measure the strength of this value? In general, that field is called a patient preference assessment. And the economic term for these values is utility. And a utility is a number that ranges from 0 to 1. And it's basically an economic concept that was developed by some Nobel Prize winners a long time ago. And it's this utility value is used, what we refer to qualities. Basically, a quality is an adjustment for how many years of life a treatment offers by a utility value. So if a utility for health state is 0.85 and you get a year, your quality is 0.85. So this is widely used in policy decisions and economic evaluations. How you measure utility, I'm not going to get into this too deeply, but the three methods of doing this are standard gamble, time trap, and rating scale. I've done a lot of work in time trade-off and now in rating scale, and they each have some significant limitations. Standard Gamble is a really complex approach to measuring your preferences for something. It doesn't work well with a lot of the kind of choices patients make because it asks them to trade off a chance of death to avoid a side effect. So that's useful when you're talking about losing a leg or a breast, perhaps, but not if you're talking about a risk of a rash or, you know, incontinence. Time trade-off has a similar problem. It was designed as a simpler version of Standard Gamble, but it has the same limitations, I think. Rating scale is easy to use inherently, but there are some concerns about the conceptual validity of the numbers that come out of it, whether those numbers have ratio-level properties. Can they be used in models? I mean, going from 7 to 8 may be different from going 9 to 10 on a rating scale psychometrically for people. So there's some issues with that as well. So my my interest has been in using what's called conjoint analysis to measure patient preferences. And that's a method taken from the world of marketing science. It's used basically to develop consumer products. So this is an example of a simple marketing survey where a consumer is offered two conceptual phones here, and they have different features, and the consumer picks which one he or she likes. The next screen has a different array of features, and you keep asking them to pick one or the other until you find, you know, the value of the trade-off between the type of network and the weight for the phone and so on. And it's been used to design many successful consumer products. So there's a real-world validation of this method, where it doesn't exist with other health services type methods, and that people actually behave and buy things that are produced with this method. So I think it does accurately measure their preferences in that regard. There's certainly, using this method, you can incorporate non-clinical treatment attributes into the preference assessment regimen, like the travel time, et cetera, that basically are harder to measure in terms of time trade-off or Standard Gamble. And I think also there's something that's intuitive about this process, that kind of blink process, which you prefer one or the other, that I think leverages that intuitive style of decision making and maybe congruent with what we know about decision making. So, I'll talk a little bit about how we developed a conjoint application for use in testing in the prostate cancer. And I wanted to talk about the very basic way we went about doing defining what was important to these guys to measure in them. And we use another marketing method called the voice of the customer approach. This might be useful for those of us getting into PCORI grants because, you know, it's obviously all about patient stakeholder engagement in PCORI. And one of our previous calls were talking about, you know, how can we best engage stakeholders to advise us on our research. I think this method has value in that it goes really from the ground up to hear what's of importance to patients. It's used in marketing because, you know, essentially product marketers thought they knew what was important about their products to their customers. Using this method, they realized they didn't know everything about their customers. Why were they buying this or that? They were surprised by their answer. And as physicians and researchers, we often assume that we know what's important to our patients. And I was surprised actually by some of the things we learned using this method. So a little bit about it. So this is animated. So basically how it starts off is listen to the patients. I'm gonna just move on here to the actual method. So we start off with interviewing men who have had the problem. So Sylvia Lambrexa and I were in a room together with many men with prostate cancer, and Sylvia was basically transcribing everything they said, which was unbelievably hard. But we interviewed them for an hour to hour and a half about their decision to have treatment for prostate cancer. And we asked open-ended questions. Is there music playing?
I don't know what that means. Robin, we may have to. Oh, it's gone.
Somebody had us on hold.
Oh, okay.
Don't put us on hold.
So we interviewed these guys and got every sentence written down. And this is a mixed methods approach. It's a quantitative and a qualitative component to it. We then sat down and created a master spreadsheet of almost 1,000 quotes that were relevant to prostate cancer treatment. These guys were talking about everything. So basically, some of these things were talking about, you know, how they disliked the VA. We include that in the quotes, but many of them were relevant. We then, this is where it becomes a bit more subjective, three independent judges in our research team sat down and created themes based on the quote. So, for example, if a lot of them were talking about, I was really afraid of leaking urine after the procedure, and there's other quotes like that, that became a theme called incontinence. So we nominated 15 of these themes, and we then took this is another very subjective part of this. Out of the 1,000 quotes, the three judges narrowed them to 70 that were most representative of these themes. And then you take the quotes, the 70 quotes you have in your themes, you put them back in front of patients who made the decision. You say, here are some suggested themes. We interview them about the decision-making process, and we say, that's very interesting. Here are some themes you've noticed in other men who made this decision, and so can you take this stack of 70 quotes and put them under the theme of interest? You can remove themes if they're not relevant, you think. You can add themes if you don't see them there. So the men did this sorting process. And after we had their data, we used a method called agglomerative hierarchical clustering, essentially to determine the psychometric distance between the piles of cards that got created. So we coded for every man, you know, which cards were in the same pile versus different cards in binary fashion. And basically, you can use this method to create themes that are more granular or more coarse based on what you're willing to live with in terms of psychometric distance. And then finally, we basically took those themes and turned them into the attributes that were tested. So instead of, say, whether your phone is a 3G network, we talked about whether, you know, is incontinence important to you, and there's levels of incontinence, none, you know, 6 months worth or permanent. So that's how we went about getting and there were some things that were surprising. I think we have them in here. So these are examples of what people had to say. These are the kinds of sentences that we got from men that were representative about treatment issues, side effects, and you know, it was quite enlightening for me as a person that treats prostate cancer and does surgery for it to sort of see in such detail how men thought about it. And I was, you know, here's a list of the, let me go back. So the ones that were surprising to me in this list were, one was around action. Basically, you know, a lot of these men felt that taking action was a critical part of the treatment they were picking. And it was independent of the type of treatment. So for some men, going on active surveillance was them taking action because they were pushing back on the doctor who was just wanted to take the prostate out. So they were saying, no, I'm going to observe this. That was action. For some men, having surgery was very action related, but taking action was an important component. And you know, the importance of others' advice was very important. Some people had a real aversion to an incision in general. Like that was just a thing. Whether or not the surgery was worthwhile didn't really matter. So these were very fascinating to me to hear about, really. So then we tested, this is from my R01 at the VA, so basically we tested this method of preference assessment in a randomized fashion against some of the older methods. And we used the attributes we developed in the first part of the experiment to use as the basis for the ratings. And we developed a rating scale method to evaluate basically multi-attribute health states based on like your incontinent, your sexual function's okay, you've had a big surgery. Those are sort of, that's one statement of what an outcome was. And they would either put a rating scale value for that, or we put them through a conjoint analysis application we developed for this process. And Ellie DeHaan developed this. He's a marketing professor at Anderson, an expert in conjoint analysis. And I told him we had to do this on the fly in the clinic using, you know, Excel spreadsheets. And he programmed it in Excel. It does, you know, a multivariate regression in Excel on the fly, you know, in real time, which is, I think, quite remarkable. He's quite a genius. So, these are the attributes that we tested the men on in terms of what was important to them about their decision. And this was done in, we had two cohorts in this study. The cohort here are men who had a prostate biopsy that showed no cancer. So this is basically men who have thought about having prostate cancer but haven't experienced it. The other cohort I'll talk about in a minute.
So this, you went from 15 to 7 by the data reduction techniques you said.
That's right. And so recruited these guys in the clinic, randomized them to rating scale versus conjoint, or time trade-off versus conjoint. These are typical, you know, sort of veteran population, overrepresented in African Americans, you know, spectrum of education and income that you expect in the VA. And to compare the outcome metrics, so this is another interesting topic. In this area of patient preference assessment, there are really no gold standards that compare rating scales, Standard Gamble, and time trade-off. There's one paper that we saw that did something like this, but I thought it was not as good as what they do in marketing science. Basically, in marketing science, what they do is they say, if you think you know this patient so well, can you predict which of these products he is going to buy. And so that is a really tough test. So that was one of our tests, and then the other test was basically, the internal validity of the utility function that we created, the R squared basically of the utility function. And we also looked at acceptability of the methods in these guys. So this is the R squared of the utility functions generated by using our data. And so both conjoint analysis and rating scale had high internal consistency in terms of the preferences that were expressed. Rating scale did not have comparable internal consistency, so men were answering in a more haphazard way, probably because of cognitive challenges, I think. This is predictive validity. So essentially, what this is looking at is if you give the man four future outcomes, one might be you have no incontinence, you have good sexual function, and you've avoided an outpatient surgery, and there's three other iterations that are like that. Do they pick? Can you tell which one they're going to pick out of the top four? So the random effect is like 25%. So you got to be 25%. In marketing science, if you're above 60%, you're doing great, and you can publish the results. So conjoint performed very well in this group, and rating scale also performed reasonably well, and triumph not as well in terms of marketing science standards. We looked at the patient satisfaction and ease of use scores. So the rating scale was probably the easiest to use, as you would expect. But in the first column, their conjoint analysis, the majority of the men were extremely or somewhat satisfied with conjoint as a method to express their opinion. So they did struggle a bit more with conjoint, spent some time thinking about it, but they did feel it was a satisfying way to express themselves in terms of their outcomes. So we concluded that this was a feasible method to get real-time, individual-level data about preferences from patients, and that it was at least had acceptable patient satisfaction as a method that was challenging.
Can you go back to something?
Yeah.
I really didn't understand that. So what were you predicting? You asked them?
So imagine you had, we analyzed the data in two different ways, which is what these two bars are. So. The men had, at the end of their exercise, when they got their preferences expressed by the conjoint analysis, they were then given two separate screens. And on one screen, there was four choices of ways they could end up after treatment. And they picked which was their favorite, right? And so we said, and we, in the background, had their utility function. We said, well, given their preferences to date, we would predict they would pick, say, choice number one, because it has the highest utility value for them. And we had two exercises like that. And one, they the conjoint stimuli, the dark blue one, they were they were rating things they'd already seen before, basically, combinations of attributes they'd seen before. The other one, the light blue one, were stimuli they'd never seen before, new combinations of incontinence and recovery time and all those things. So. That's for that. We did it two ways for a variety of experimental reasons, but we have two different ways to look at it, and that's what that means. That makes sense?
Is it the combination of the seven things that could be in the state that they're predicting? And you're giving them all seven things somehow varied, and you say you want this one or that one?
Correct. Okay. All right. All right, so then the other component of my work at the VA is to look at the additive value of preference assessment over straightforward decision support. And with that, we looked at men who had a positive biopsy for prostate cancer. So these are guys who have to make a decision. And what we did was we randomized them. Everyone got a pamphlet that is an excellent decision aid produced by University of Michigan about prostate cancer. Thorough, balanced, written at a great education level. It's great. And we then randomized half the men to get preference assessment done using conjoint analysis. And these are all pilot data. This is ongoing. So these are small n's. So after the patient got the conjoint analysis done, we printed a report out for them saying, here is your preference report. Your number one concern was sexual dysfunction. Your number two concern was X. And the patient sat down with the physician, who we told the physician what was going on, obviously. And they use that as a guide with the physician to discuss their treatment options. And our hope was that this would allow the consultation to focus on what was important to the patient. That if they felt inhibited about discussing their concerns, that they would have a platform upon which to discuss it with the physician, that the physician would have a more effective discussion with the patient, and it'd be a shorter visit with the physician because they've been educated and they've had their preferences assessed. So this is an example, it doesn't show very well on the screen, sorry, of the report. Basically, and this says, like, you know, the number one thing for this person was sex life, followed by urination concerns. Those are the top two dominant. This is a sample one that Ellie did himself. So in this report, that's all they would talk about as their dominant concerns, basically. And we looked at measures of decision quality, satisfaction with care. There's a prostate cancer-specific instrument for this. Disease-specific knowledge. We borrowed something from IMPACT that Dr. Littman was involved with. Decision conflict scale, which you guys are probably familiar with. Measure of shared decision-making. And then whether they made a treatment choice or not. And so, sorry, this top header didn't come up, but basically, this is comparing post use of the aid with pre-use of the aid, and this is the aid, and this is the control group. So, this is decisional complex scale, and basically, these are the subscales: uncertainty, perceived protective decision making, and factors between uncertainty. And essentially, a higher score is worse. So we see greater reductions in uncertainty and improvements in perceived effective decision making in patients who got preference assessment versus those that didn't. And the total score also for decisional conflict dropped in men who got preference assessment in addition to education. And the next one is basically, and this is, sorry, the header's there. This is basically the some of the specific items in the decisional conflict scale. And some of them were to date significant, but still small ends, 25 versus 28. this is satisfaction with care, and some of these items have become significant. Thoroughness of the main cancer practitioner. If you got preference assessment, there's a perception that your doctor is more thorough with you. I think maybe because you had that report to discuss with them. These are all compiled data. Knowledge didn't change very much, so I wouldn't think that it would because both groups got that really excellent decision aid. So they both improved in terms of pre-post getting the aid, but there's no difference between the two groups. So we concluded that basically it's feasible to do this in clinic in real time, and that our pilot data show increased patient satisfaction with their thoroughness of the cancer practitioner and reduced decisional conflict. And that was, I think, you know, for our pilot data, pretty encouraging. So our next frontiers, and I'll finish with this, are there's two of them. One is that we are taking the leap in our department to put in a integrated decision analysis preference assessment application in for men with prostate cancer. So this will go beyond just what, you know, the research arm is doing in terms of conjoint analysis, but looking at the full Megillah, having that decision analysis model baked into the application, and then applying the values that the men have elicited to that model, and then providing them with an analysis of what might be best for them in terms of decision making. And then so the doctor with the report hopefully have that higher quality decision making encounter that's shorter for the doctor. So that should be starting, and Sylvia will be working with me on that in a few weeks, hopefully. And the other frontier for this work is a PCORI grant. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, it's interesting with these decision aids, a patient can use them and feel empowered, then sit down with the doctor, and perhaps it all falls apart. There's, you know, other cultural elements, psychological elements that we don't know that are operating in them, so they're not really efficacious in that discussion. And, you know, there's not a lot of work on how to modify decision aids to make them more effective at their goals, which is basically to encourage behaviors with doctors. And with Dominic Frosch and Glenn Elliman, we developed a PCORI proposal that aims to have men use a decision aid like we talked about here, and use what's called the integrative model, which is a psychological model that takes into account self-efficacy, attitudes about medical care, and can be used perhaps to predict intention to engage in shared decision making. So we'll measure whether the decision aid affects these elements of the integrative model that predict intention. Then we're going to have them sit down with the doctor for the discussion and actually audio tape that discussion. This is that all of you are planning to do it. And then code those interviews. There's an option scale developed by Glenn Elliman which can actually quantify the degree of shared decision making that goes on in the interview. And then with that result, try to stratify who had more behavior that we thought was better for shared decision making, and could we trace that back to the integrative model? And if we found constructs in the model that were basically underpinning some of that lack of behavior, we modify the aid. So for example, if self-efficacy was low in men who had low shared decision-making behavior in clinic, can we then add in elements to the aid that show, that basically model a patient discussing the situation with a doctor that might augment their sense of efficacy and make the aid even more valuable? Another option of this work is with Maya Levy, who's here, a resident in our department. She's interested in patient engagement, and she is doing a voice of the customer patient analysis in patients who have failed treatment for overactive bladder. So she's basically doing this process in a whole other domain in urology, and so we'll see how that goes this year. She's just recruiting her first patients. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Beautiful presentation, and it sounds exactly like what PCORI wants. That sounds like a really good PCORI proposal. And I shared with Chris, the word is that if you made it to the second round of review, you have about a 20% chance of getting PCORI funding. This time around, the chances are a lot better than they were last time.
20 is a good number.
20 is a good number. 1 to 5. Yeah, so we're gonna open it up for questions, and a number of you are on the line, so you can jump in too if you have a question. Just identify yourself first.
Yes. I'm Connie Fallon from the VA, geriatrics. And this is really interesting. One question I have is about the decision aid literature. It talks about it encourages people to consider the opinions of like their spouse or family. People are pressuring them one way or another. And I'm just wondering, with this technique, how do you envision incorporating others' opinions into this process?
So how we're doing it basically is that if in any decision you have, if the opinions of others is important as an attribute, then in the model where the full McGill model happens, you could have a slot where others agree with this, and if you put that into the model, basically. It's very, very personalized to ask them, well, what does your wife think, and so on. But in terms of the straight preference measurement, we can measure whether that's important to the person. So we have a model whether significant others agree with you or not, yes or no. If they keep not including that as an important value for them, it drops down as it basically utility of very, very low to them. They don't care about it. So you can measure the importance of that in the person. And there's a way to incorporate that preference of others into their decision. It's a little hard to systematize that, though. Right?
A lot of times when you're doing these preference assessments, you're wondering whether people know what they're rating. So like, these are naive. They haven't yet gone through treatment. You're talking about incontinence and sexual dysfunction and so forth. And maybe it's obvious, but you didn't do anything except just sort of tell them the labels.
They basically got education beforehand about prostate cancer. That pamphlet that I talked about has descriptions of incontinence and sexual dysfunction and so on. So that's there for them to read. But the corollary of what you raise is important, is basically, can people accurately imagine how they would react to incontinence or sexual dysfunction or anything like that? And probably we're not good at doing that. In my earlier work in like the 90s in time trade-off, I had like 400 men use the time trade-off thing, and we followed their preferences over time. And as they went through treatment and experienced incontinence and so on, their utilities for those side effects went up. Actually, for many of them, they were okay. Their current health state included incontinence, and their utility for that went up. So I think there's a lot of positive accommodation and negative accommodation too. I think the fact of the matter is, as physicians, we've got to help them make a decision in the now. So we give them the best we can. I think video snippets are very helpful. Health Dialogue has all these men talking about their struggle with incontinence. That may be helpful for some people. So there's ways to try to really educate them that probably are even more dimensional than we do right now. But that's an important point.
Brian Hittman of the VA. Can you talk a little bit more about the comparison condition in the second study, specifically specifically whether we can be confident in attributing the differences in satisfaction, decisional conflict, and so on to the specific content of the preference assessment versus the fact that there was more time and attention and interest shown, a discussion with the physician and so on. Were there comparable mm-hmm. activities in the comparison?
So if you were in the comparison group, you got attention from the study coordinator, and you sat down and you were educated, and then you went to the doctor and you didn't have that sit down that went over the report. But I think that's an important comparator. So I'm hoping that was part of the impact.
In which case, the question is whether there's some sham, report and discussion that you could have just as a slightly, higher quality comparison and test. Do you need this level of preparation, or could you encourage the physician to devote 5 minutes to an open-ended, more traditional discussion of preferences and achieve the same reduction in conflict, the same increase in satisfaction?
Yeah, I guess you could. I think that most, that clinic, the doctors there do discuss the patient's preferences, not in an organized way. I guess it's one thing we could think about doing.
Were the times shorter with the preference assessment?
That we have measured exactly, but we will measure that at UCLA.
So you could see, if even though they're going over the report, the visit time is shorter, sure. They're essentially getting more attention than the other visit. Quantitatively.
So better quality, more effective.
Right, that's the goal, I think, the ultimate goal.
That's right.
You're talking about behavioral economics and how this has introduced new thought in this field. And Bob Brooks recently said one of the most disturbing books he's read is Thinking Fast and Slow, which is about how irrational our decision making is. I start to think that this gets at the surface, what people think they want, not knowing what's really going to make them happy and what's rational. Mm-hmm. And if our next generation of this will be more leading them to understand their own decision making better.
Hopefully, yeah. That's what you can do when you collect the data. You can analyze it for them and provide them with the dashboard.
He said this last year. He's just like you, but now he wishes he hadn't. Right.
Exactly. Right.
So how does it work on site? What is there? So it's.
So we have a laptop basically in the VA at least. And the study coordinator sits down with the patients, and they're kind of in the same room, but they don't intervene too much. And after introducing the task, the patient just goes at it with a laptop.
And it will turn into an app?
At UCLA, it will turn into an app. Uh-huh. So, that's our next evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So when physicians are talking to patients about radiation versus surgery versus oscillation, are they thinking now in terms of these dimensions that the patients have identified, and do they have preferences themselves that they can identify and sort of say, for you, since this is important, I would say radiation might be something that seems wrong with that. Is there any connection out there with the physicians are doing?
We have not. You said we're going to measure that a bit more carefully, but in the VA, it's all anecdotal comments from the counseling physicians that have liked the process. But certainly, the idea is a hypothesis that basically, if you know what's important to the patient, you can match that treatment more closely to their preferences. And so, one of the outcomes of this study will be we have mature data. We can look at their expressed preferences and how often they got a treatment that matched that. And that's what we'll be collecting, in the next year and a half, hopefully, as we get closer to a larger number.
Any thoughts?
Do you have any IRB issues about this decision making?
Oh, no. we had just the usual roadblocks that,
But was there something particular about involving the patient in decision making?
Not really. There's all kinds of, we had we had tons of internet of discussions, but nothing that was particularly unusual, I thought, so.
Did you hear Jerome Krugman when he was here?
I didn't, but I read his editorial, his essay in JAMA last week about, it was an interesting article about decision analysis and patient preference assessment and public policy. It was a really interesting article, mm-hmm. in last week's JAMA. Mm-hmm. Why do you ask?
Oh, he came promoting his book, How Doctors Think, and mm-hmm. he had said that a big part of this is coming from where your background is. So he came from a traditional Orthodox Jewish background where the doctor was God and you did whatever they told you, and his wife came from a naturalistic, stay away from hospitals, they will kill you, and that, you know, these were the driving force in all of their decision making, actually also as physicians. And you know, I'm trying to see, where is the level of that in deciding what people are going to want?
What the position? Oh, they're
a priori, right, where you said the one would say, don't ever cut me, and the other says, you know, do something.
That's pretty deep. I don't know where it comes from. Yeah. A lot of roots causes that.
So one of the things that I'm often envious about for your job or Mark's job is when I think about urology, it seems a lot cleaner than what I do in general internal medicine. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you've had a role, any space in the research you laid out here, very nicely laid out, for the complex patient who has multiple comorbidities and, you know, challenges.
Sure. Well, so in terms of preference assessment, how will that affect the preferences, you mean?
Well, I think there's multiple levels of it, and maybe one of the earlier ones is, how does the patient even conceptualize what their preferences are for this decision, given that they're always health-wise making multiple decisions, you know, and each one interacts with the others. And I don't know whether most people might not explicitly understand how they interact, but.
Sure. Well, you know, I'd say that there's a few ways to look at that. One is, at least in the marketing world, they do what are called market segmentation analyses. And they can, if you have large enough N, you can create essentially what types of patients are interested in what types of outcomes. And that's, you know, and actually you can shorten the interview process with them because they begin answering a certain pattern. And I believe that would be a very consistent sort of thing across healthcare. I bet we would have, you know, all of us that see patients, there are certain types of patients that we see. And so I bet you could begin to define them based on their preferences. That's what happens in marketing science. So that's one avenue of exploration for that topic, I think. You know, for decision analysis, as you all know, you try to incorporate those outcomes as you can, supported by data about how their comorbidities affect their outcomes. And that can operate in the background for them in a properly built model, but that's the devil's in the details there.
But I think there are some very unique and, you know, nice, clean features of this kind of situation. You know, it's a clear decision, there are reasonable alternatives, we know about the alternatives, we know the, you know, different consequences and so on. So it's much more comparable to, you know, going into a store and making a decision about a product, as opposed to situations where, in some cases, there aren't decisions that are available, and when there are, it's a much more complicated, amorphous set of issues.
Mm-hmm. The growth area of research, if anyone's interested.
Do you have on your team somebody from the marketing research area from the Anderson School?
Yeah, so Elie DeHaan was actually an Anderson professor when I first met him, and he actually moved on from there and is in our department as a researcher now. So he's a marketing professor, and a real, in that world, there's like, there are researchers and practitioners of marketing science that are basically employed. He kind of lives in the middle, kind of like most of us doctors do. We have a research arm and a clinic that we go to. So it's kind of like, that's what he's a bit like that too.
Interesting. So it's not a joint appointment. He's moved over fully.
Yeah, he's basically a researcher in our department.
What else do you have on your team?
Oh, we have, it's an A team.
So after thinking about prostate decisions, what other clinical conditions do you think map nicely to the methods that you've developed?
Well, certainly, Maya's working on in the world of incontinence. I think that this approach in general is applied to high variance conditions that are expensive. So I think a lot of women's health issues, fibroid treatment, for example, orthopedic issues, knee, vertebral disc herniation, there's a lot, even PSA screening, I think, could be addressed. And I think that's a very relevant one now. So I'm thinking about developing something in that area. And so I think really the areas that have been traditionally targets for shared decision making are the ones that I think these are best served by, highly prevalent things where there's a lot of decision making happens at one concentrated time point.
Do the women have any role in this decision making?
They sure do. You know, and you know, again, it's hard to. I mean, this is to support the man's thinking process. but it's not meant to replace a discussion with a doctor or a discussion with their wife or whomever is important to them. So it's one more bit of support they don't have right now. But and this is usually, it's often a couple, if a man's married, it's often a couple's decision, so.
I just throw out an anecdotal comment about being a physician in the room with the patients. It's tremendously helpful. I mean, it really helps me, you know, instead of having to spend a lot of the valuable encounter time trying to tease out someone's preferences as the best I can and not knowing, well, how much are they just telling me because I'm the doctor and how much are they unwilling to say because I'm a partner. You know, I can see the sheet and very rapidly sort of triage people. Well, there's some very clear preferences expressed. And that, you know, as Maya pointed out, really helps me tailor my counseling to them, tailor my interaction with them. And so I think it just makes a lot more efficient use of my time, and I find it very, very helpful. And I think that, you know, it's part of the whole intervention. I would say it's, you know, there's the computer terminal part where they're putting their information in, but you can't, I think it's really hard to separate that out from the value that you get from the physician's interaction. So I view it as kind of a package deal from the provider's perspective.
Can I quote you on that?
Yes.
Have either of you had experiences where you're looking at the sheet and you're articulating your concerns and comments for the patient and realizing that what you think based on what's on that paper in terms of their preferences doesn't match what the patient's experiencing at the moment?
Well, I don't actually counsel them, so I don't know. I've never had that experience.
Yeah, I haven't had that experience so much. Sometimes it's really good. Sometimes it's very helpful when they have a preference that's very discordant with what I might counsel them. So, you know, if they have a lot of comorbid conditions and I'm really concerned about them as a cervical candidate, it helps me really break down and say, look, I understand this is what you've heard, but this is why I really think as a surgeon, this would be a bad choice for you. So in that sense, when their preferences may be discordant from the medical implications of their decision, it's actually useful. But I haven't seen a situation where she says one thing, so I'm getting a different viewpoint from the patient.
Are you interviewing the physicians? You know, when I think about the next step, so once you're done with this and you have a program that you know is effective, you know, thinking about implementation, what it will take to convince the physicians to play along and the system and so on, is that part of the current study or your planned next study?
That's part of the next study at UCLA. So that's a critical, that's really where these programs tend to really hit, the, as you well know. It's all about implementation and making it work for the doctors and in a busy clinical situation. So we're going to learn a lot about that. And maybe I'll bounce some ideas off of you as we go along.
And PCORI's funding that too.
Right, another grant.
January, January.
One of the things that I think is interesting, and I understand as a clinician and as a researcher, that the idea that we could speed up the way patients make decisions seems like a great idea. But on the other hand, you know, these decisions are really complex and they're often pushing people and their personal selves and to get crisper decisions for, like you say, something really important in their life. And in a way, it's kind of cruel to ask people to do it in a rush. Sure. I mean, it's good to try to help them along, but in a way, it might be an unrealistic goal for us. And even though that may be one of our best measurable parameters for us as researchers, I just don't know if it's a really valid outcome.
I agree. I think so speed itself is not the goal. I mean, the goal is value. It's kind of the same thing. Is the patient satisfaction high? As Maya was saying, do you have a more valuable discussion? You can have a 60-minute talk about nothing with a patient, where no one, you're just blabbing at them, they're not really listening. So basically, I want to make that discussion more, if it's still 60 minutes, but it's a better value discussion, that's what we're looking for. Many times it'll be shorter, I think, but we don't know.
This is great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting. As I mentioned earlier, slides are available on the website, and you're going to get some changes in dates because of the upcoming holidays, but we'll send that around to everyone. Thanks a million.
All right, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. That was perfect. Perfect.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Bye now. Did we,
Robert, everything's at your end.
So, what about our
they were going to respond to any of the federal counterparts.
Yes. Two things happened. One was, he said he did.
Hands really.
And he had a student. The other thing was, I had mentioned to Caleb that he was a but then he has to do the evaluation. What that means and that's what the plan is there.
Sure.
But I wasn't going to bring that up because I had hoped the other one would be.
Are you wanting Max to be?
So
yes.
I think the strategy number one would be appointment itself. So that you're not coming in and saying you're from the VA, you'll send this one to the VA.
Sure, I'm
yeah. we said where that stands and give her a nudge, but the other is sending them.
Sure.
But CC me as well, because I did start that discussion and brought it up at the operations meeting, brought it up here, and then found out, well, if you do this, then that could happen. Mm-hmm. And I heard Jules talk about it, and I don't know if that discussion happened or not. I also know that CTSI right now is in there. Their end of year, what's APR, annual program or project
reporting requirement.
And that for my project, they were